Those who got the Johnson & Johnson vaccine finally got a boost, so to speak, this week, because the company announced that a second shot of the vaccine provides 94% protection against symptomatic COVID-19 infection, bringing its numbers up to Moderna or Pfizer-level protection. They have submitted the numbers to the FDA for booster consideration. Now, this after confusing mixed messages on booster shots from the White House, then the FDA, and after Pfizer announced promising results of studies on its vaccine for children between the ages of 5 and 11. That, of course, while Massachusetts announces more than 4,000 new COVID cases over the weekend, as positivity stays at 2%. With school infections, we wonder, are things getting better? Where are we on COVID? And that means that it is time to ask the doctors, what do you need to know about timing of shots, safety in schools, preparations for colder weather? Call with those questions, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. With us this week to help answer them, Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College, and Dr. Shira Daron, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center. Dr. Landrigan, welcome back.
Sienna, nice to be with you. Thanks.
And Dr. Daron, welcome back to you, too.
Great to be back. Thank you.
So, Dr. Landrigan, this news about the Johnson & Johnson shot, according to the company and a clinical trial it ran, a second dose significantly increases protection against severe sickness and death. What do you make of the announcement?
It's good news. Obviously, anything that leads to robust, solid vaccination of more of the population is good. It'll protect the individuals who receive the booster, and it'll also contribute to slowing the spread of infection through the community.
So, Dr. Daron, I feel like over the last few weeks on Ask the Doctors, people who have received the J&J vaccine have been calling in looking for some love, looking for any attention. It's not authorized yet, a second dose. So in the meantime, what should the almost 15 million recipients of the J&J shot kind of do with this information? How should they think about it?
No, I know. It's so hard. The J&J recipients almost feel like they've been left hanging out to dry with the lack of information. I think, you know, the press release today from J&J had a couple of really important pieces of information. Not only does a boost at 2 months help, not only does a boost at 6 months really drive the antibody levels way, way up there, 12 times as high, but it also stated that the J&J recipients are not seeing the same kind of waning of immunity that the Pfizer recipients
single dose J&J recipients, you mean?
Single dose J&J recipients. And so, you know, you don't have to worry as much that things are changing for you over time. Delta does change the equation. It is more transmissible and you have to take more precautions. But you're not less protected than you were before, which is a good sign. I really hope that when the CDC's ACIP, the Advisory Council on Immunization Practices, meets tomorrow and the next day, that they address or at least give us some sense of when we can expect to hear something from them regarding their recommendation. Because there are mix and match studies ongoing where you could get a dose of a different vaccine. And, you know, this just may be a situation where we need some guidance that may be sort of outside of necessarily the FDA approval process.
Well, the calls are coming in, and we already have one on the line on the J&J vaccine. So 1-800-423-8255 to ask your coronavirus question of Drs. Landrigan and Daron. We've got Arison on the line in Reading. Arison, go ahead. Excuse me, Arison.
Yeah, Arison, that's right. Thanks. So my whole family actually just got COVID. My husband and I, who are vaccinated with the Johnson & Johnson, and then my two school-age children, who are both under 11, and one of my children is like just about to come out of quarantine on Thursday. And so we're on the tail end of it. But what I'm wondering is, with all of these, like, okay, maybe we can get a J&J booster shot, or maybe the kids can possibly get vaccinated sometime in the next couple of months. Like, where are we at right now in terms of, like, when can I get a booster shot now that I've just had COVID? And when can they get a vaccine now that they've just had COVID?
And Arison, I'm going to turn to Dr. Landrigan in a second to answer that. But while I have you, I'm going to ask, I'm noting four family members who got ill. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you all have relatively mild cases? You and your husband had already been vaccinated.
Yes, we did. We did. I mean, it felt, you know, it felt like a bad cold. I'll be honest. It felt like a bad cold. I was not happy about it. If I didn't have to quarantine, I probably would have stayed home from work. But, you know, it wasn't, like, at no point did it even occur to us, like, we should be going to the hospital or anything. You know, it just felt, it was just a bad cold.
Thank you for clarifying. I appreciate that. So, Dr. Landrigan, I think the biggest part of Arisen's question has to do with that time, because J&J's not approved yet for a booster, but what's the window after someone has been positive for COVID when they can get a shot?
Tiziana, let me pass that one to Dr. Durone.
Dr. Durone.
Yeah. You know, natural immunity is quite effective, at least for some time. And I almost never see cases of reinfection after infection. The exception is really very immunocompromised people. And so while the CDC says that you can get vaccinated anytime after you're no longer in isolation for your infection, and so technically once a booster is approved for your age group or for your eligibility category, you can get it anytime. But you also could ride out some of your own natural immunity and kind of extend that period, basically, of immunity. So if you waited 3 months, because reinfection is exceedingly uncommon within 3 months, if you waited 3 months from your infection and then got booster, if it was approved for you, that would be a good solid strategy that doesn't carry risk.
Thanks, Dr. Durone. 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also tweet us at Radio Boston. Let's pick up Miriam in Braintree. Hi, Miriam. What's your question?
Hi there. I'm having some trouble understanding the rationale behind the decision about priority at hospitals across the country that are so overcrowded. I just don't understand why unvaccinated COVID patients are the ones being prioritized, and people with other emergent needs, such as heart attacks and car accidents and whatever have you, are the ones being made to wait or not receiving care at all.
Miriam, this is assuming hospitals are turning people away.
I've never heard an authoritative reason for that priority decision, and it seems to me it ought to be the other way around.
So let's get you an answer, Miriam. Thanks for that call. And Dr. Landrigan, we're going to assume, I'm assuming Miriam's talking about reports where you hear that maybe someone's been turned away from a hospital that's full. This feels like a medical ethics question. Can you help Miriam break it down?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, because I've worked in emergency rooms like most doctors, and what physicians in emergency rooms do is they prioritize, they triage, they try to take care of everybody, but resources are limited, and so you have to focus on the sickest people. I've heard those reports, too, of people in some of the southern states and western states where people with myocardial infarctions or severe trauma have had to be turned away. It's awful hard to comment on particular cases when you're not there. But I think, for the most part, doctors and nurses and ERs do the best they can with what they have. And we all wish that those people who have stubbornly refused to get vaccinated for whatever reason would please pay attention to the science and get themselves vaccinated.
Let's pick up another call here. 800-423-8255 is the number. We've got Kate on the line in Tewksbury. Kate, go ahead.
Hi. My question is about close contacts in school and there being not a need to test or quarantine if you're vaccinated, but whether or not the state actually makes that differentiation.
So, Dr. Durone, I think this comes down to the sort of test and stay approach that a lot of school districts are taking. So perhaps you can explain that and then compare and contrast that with state contact tracing guidelines, if you could, please.
Yeah, sure. I can explain test and stay. And I think the caller was actually also asking about the state's policy that a vaccinated individual is not considered a close contact for the purpose of quarantine.
Perfect.
So, you know, before anyone was vaccinated and before test and stay, a close contact was anyone that came within 6 feet of an infected person while that person was in the contagious period for at least 15 minutes, and it became 15 minutes cumulative over a 24-hour period. Now, there have been a few modifications, particularly in Massachusetts. Massachusetts was the first to say that children could be within 3 feet of each other in school, and as long as they were masked or on a bus with the windows open and masked, they were not considered a close contact. And the CDC ended up adopting that because the data were very strong that transmission was not happening in those situations. And so if we were going to put our children within 3 feet of each other in order to fit them all in the building and say that that is safe, which we did say, it made sense to also say that that wasn't a close contact. And that's working. We're not seeing any increased risk from doing that. Then you add the test to stay program. So if you are within 3 feet or you're within 6 feet and don't have masks on, you're a close contact. That happens at school. And in that situation, those close contacts in school, you can keep going to school and extracurricular activities at school as long as you have an antigen Binax Now test each morning on your way in, and it's negative. And that was studied very, very carefully and a couple of times, but in a really well done large scale trial in the UK, it was found to essentially add no risk over the routine sort of quarantine. Now, the question I think the caller wants to know is, but what about those close contacts that occur in people who are vaccinated? They're not considered exposed. So they neither quarantine nor do they do test and stay. And yet we know that the vaccines have become less effective, both due to Delta and due to waning immunity. And I think, you know, there is a gray area there. It's the vaccines are not perfect. There will be some transmissions, but when you have highly vaccinated people interacting with highly vaccinated people or fully vaccinated people in a highly vaccinated environment, you might see some transmission. But what you don't expect to see is outbreaks that catch fire and spread, and you don't expect to see significant morbidity or mortality, so significant illness or hospitalizations. And we are going to have to get to a point where when we are well vaccinated and highly immune, we tolerate some transmission.
Thank you for that, Dr. Derone. I'm going to go back to the phones here for Mia in Salem. Mia, go ahead with your question.
Hi there. First of all, doctors, thank you so much for all of your hard work and years of studying. And thank you, WBUR, for serving the public with the news. Just wanted to say that real quick. I am calling on behalf of a family member who's on the other side of the spectrum. He is an anti-vaxxer, anti-masker. And he keeps trying to argue something about the 28 proteins in the virus, about the spike protein is only one part of the studies and why they show natural immunity, and how it's stronger because you have the full spectrum of antibodies against all the proteins. This is just a text message that I read, and he's done surface level looking into this, whereas you guys have years and years of research on your end. So just wondering what you could say to someone like him who's asking this question.
Who would like to take that one?
This is Dr. Landry, and I can talk to that. So, you know, there's a lot of misinformation out there about the vaccines, and you may have seen some of the stories, like the story in the New York Times a few weeks ago about the person in Florida who has made a business out of peddling misinformation about the vaccine, and some of the misinformation is incredibly detailed, talking about all these proteins and things. I think what people who have read this stuff have to ask themselves a couple of questions. One question to ask is when you read something about the vaccine, ask yourself, does the person who's putting out this information have anything to lose? If a licensed physician, such as Dr. Drone or myself, were to put out some unscientific information about a vaccine that ended up costing people their lives, we could lose our medical license. Have very severe consequences on us. By contrast, somebody who likes to type blogs at night has nothing to lose if it turns out the information is false. So that's one thing to bear in mind. The second thing is that people who read this stuff and get into it have to really ask themselves very personal questions. Do you want to be around next Christmas to see your grandchildren? That kind of thing. because if you insist on not getting vaccinated, and especially if you're over the age of 55, then the risk of your getting severe illness and even dying is much higher, many times higher than the person who follows the science and gets themselves vaccinated. I realize it's not easy, especially within the family setting, to have these conversations, but these are hard conversations that people need to have.
So thank you for that, Dr. Landrigan. And that's going to give me a chance, Dr. Durone, I want to build on that, to come back to you. So with what Dr. Landrigan was just saying about misinformation, we're also talking about perception of the efficacy of vaccines. You had RSN, who called in a little bit ago and said on air, my husband and I both vaccinated with J&J, and we got the coronavirus. I'm thinking also, Radio Boston producer Chris Siderk and I did a segment on the Red Sox and their COVID outbreak of 12 COVID-19 positive cases. The original case came from a vaccinated player, Kike Hernandez, and that led to some calls, including a caller we put on air last Friday saying, well, what about this vaccine efficacy thing then? If you can have an outbreak of 12 people testing positive when the zero case or the first case was a person who was vaccinated. Now, I know what the counter arguments are, but you are the one, as Dr. Landrigan said, who put in all the work and whose license is on the line. So let me have you, with great authority, answer those concerns.
Yeah, I'm talking about this a lot these days because we have a vaccine mandate for our employees here. And I've been doing one-on-one kind of counseling sessions, trying to explain to people why I believe so much in the vaccine and why I myself chose to be vaccinated. And I think, you know, there's a couple of questions we have to ask ourselves. You know, what do we want the vaccine to do for us? What was the purpose of developing the vaccine? And where do we want to be? We developed the vaccine to prevent severe disease and death and long-term consequences. And where we want to be is in a place where this virus is not gone. It's not going to be gone. We can't get there. We want to be in a place where this virus is like a common cold or flu and we can live with it. And that's what immunity will do. Widespread immunity will make it so that the virus is still circulating, but we're okay with it because we're not getting very sick from it. And so the two kind of headlines that I hear a lot that people, or the way people interpret headlines and it's wrong, are the vaccine doesn't work. You know, people are still getting infected, so why would I take it? And, you know, the CDC said that vaccinated people transmit the same as unvaccinated people. So why do you care if I'm vaccinated? And, you know, both of those are sort of slightly wrong, right? The vaccine does still work. It's not working as well as it used to. We are seeing more breakthrough cases. That's because of Delta and probably some waning immunity. But you're still way less likely to get COVID in the first place if you're vaccinated, and even more less likely to end up in the hospital or end up dying. And vaccinated people can transmit to unvaccinated people, but they're less likely to have it in the first place. And now we know that they also, although they may have a high viral load at an early point in disease, have a more rapid drop off of that viral load and a more rapid drop off of their contagiousness.
Thank you for that. So we had a tweeted question. Borakua in Boston says, I originally received J&J in March 2021, then in June with the impending Delta surge coming. Little was relayed to J&J recipients about what to do next after hearing a podcast by @AceLavitt, who was former Biden White House senior advisor for the COVID response, Andy Slavitt. I took it upon myself to get a Moderna booster one shot in June. What do I do now? Dr. Landrigan, just briefly, any thoughts there?
It sounds to me like that person is well protected and they should get on with their life.
Okay. I love those straightforward answers, right? Get on with your life. So producer Jamie Bologna is saying, okay, should they have gotten a shot without authorization from the FDA? Was this off-label? You know, I know there are people out there. You both know there are people out there, Dr. Durone, thinking about second doses, regardless of what the FDA has to say.
I really advise people to follow what the CDC's Advisory Council on Immunization Practice recommends. Our vaccine center administers vaccines strictly according to their recommendations. They spend days talking about all of the data and deciding what is in the best interest of Americans, and I would follow that. I realize that Mr. Slavitt has made different recommendations.
And Dr. Landrigan, we're expecting more from the Biden administration or the FDA in the next day or two regarding Pfizer and third doses, correct?
Yes, it looks as though probably what's going to come out is a recommendation that people over a certain age get a third dose, or people at high risk occupations, or high risk by virtue of underlying medical conditions. And so if that is indeed the recommendation that comes, as it seems to be, then let me echo what Dr. Drone said, that the people who make those recommendations have given intense thought to them, and the general public should heed them. Likewise, if it's probably a little bit ahead of things here, but if a recommendation comes down the pike in a few weeks or months, that children should, under the age of 11, should get vaccinated, if that's approved, then by all means, people should move as rapidly as possible to follow that recommendation.
And that would be, Dr. Drone, most likely the Pfizer vaccine, since it's furthest ahead in presenting data about the efficacy and safety for kids ages 5 to 11, correct?
Definitely.
All right. That was so helpful. Dr. Shira Drone, infectious disease physician and hospital epidemiologist at Tufts Medical Center, thanks so much for your help.
Thank you.
And Dr. Philip Landrigan, a pediatrician, public health physician, epidemiologist, and director of the Program for Global Public Health and the Common Good at Boston College. Thanks for joining us today for Ask the Doctors.
Thank you, Tatiana. Bye-bye.
That's our show for today, folks. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. We had engineering help today from Patrick O'Connor. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I am Tiziana Deering. Thank you for listening and calling, and do join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.